So, at assessment, you've done all the things, you've been through all the boxes, you've explained things, you've asked questions, all sorts of stuff. You've come to the other end. So, now, John, tell me, do you feel you'd like to go ahead with this? Do you want to learn AT? And, oh, yes, I'm absolutely fascinated. I want to get started as soon as possible. Okay. Well, what we want to do is to find 9 weekly appointments. If we can manage those at the same time each week, that's always nice. You've got a sort of present routine going on in the brain. Oh, yes, going to be talking to Donna about that next week, or on Tuesday, or whatever it might be. So, what is your preferred time for a session, do you think? Well, what can we both manage? And so that was where you were beginning to bump into some problems, wasn't it, Sebastian, with your client, with when you might manage.
So yeah, this is what we discuss during the assessment. I said, do you think you'll be able to, because it's a commitment. It's like 10, 11, and I think at this point we have to sign, I mean, whenever we will work as therapists, you have to sign the contract after the assessment or before.
I think I would give it to them on week one. Maybe you're going to do everything online, aren't you, anyway? So you're just going to send it to them to sign at some point, whatever it's going to be. I don't bother with a signature because but I do send them information, which we will cover. Now I'll send you some things through. So that's procedural, really, isn't it? It's procedural. So this is the other bit of amalgamating diaries. And I always say I can never do Fridays, but otherwise I can be quite flexible. So, hey, we find a time. And can you do the 9 weeks? It's only 9 weeks you're looking at. You've already done the 10th one because that's the assessment. And the 11th one is a refresher, which is way ahead. So you're looking for 9 weekly appointments. Okay. And if those can go in the diary straight away and you hit on 5 o'clock on a Tuesday, then put them all in straight away. And even if somebody says, I'm not quite sure about that one, put it in anyway, because it focuses the mind and it doesn't leave anything open. I've always got a story. I'm still working with someone who I've started last October. And she's never had her final session. There have been so many things that have got in the way. It's not at all how I want to teach AT. And most of them were her problems. There were some of them work problems. Then there was travel problems. She couldn't get home. Then there was this. Then there was that. And we just muddled along. It was the only thing to do. We muddled along. She was very keen to keep going. But it did make her practice drop sometimes because the momentum was lost. And that's the thing with this brief therapy we have. It does gather its momentum. I'm sure Patricia and Donna would agree with that. There's a sort of introductory phase of it, and then there's heavy and there's warm, and we're still sort of finding our way a bit. And then we get to heartbeat and breathing, and we're really in the heart of it at that point. And then suddenly, oh, wow, we finished. Gosh. So it's got that sort of momentum, and it's very easy for things to slip and for people to forget. So I'm absolutely adamant about putting in the dates before you even start. Even if, I mean, we did with this woman, but I kept rubbing them out in my diary and then rubbing out another one, and we moved on another couple of weeks. It was very difficult. And somebody else recently started with me. The assessment was in February, but she's now just coming to the end of the course. And she had 4 or 5 weeks off. Her father suddenly died. But she had even said during that, oh, I've got to stay with my mother now, but I'm sure I can carry on. I want to go by Zoom, and I think I can get a bit of practice done. And I thought, no, that's the wrong mindset. That absolutely, I said, no, I won't allow that. I replied back, you're in a bereavement now and you're caring for someone else. The chances of you keeping up a consistency in your AT right now is very low. So I gave her the hold exercise. She had just done warmth, which was quite convenient. So I gave her the hold exercise. I said, carry that forward. I'm putting a note in my diary to call you in a month's time, and we'll see how you are. But you can carry on with this, with whatever practice time you have. And so she did. And she's now just coming to the end. And actually, it served her well because she was one of those people, or is one of those people, by her own admission, always wanting results, always wanting to be better, always wanting to be there. And she wanted to know if she could do the course more quickly than in than 8 or 9 weeks. And I said, well, that's an interesting question. Well, I want to be better. That's an even more interesting question. I really can't answer any of that, I said. We've actually got to give ourselves over to the process. So that actually has to take time. Then this happened with her father, so she was taking even more time. But actually, she somehow, in that gap, learned quite a lot about listening to herself and allowing things, not looking for results. It was absolutely brilliant. And when we did get together again, she reported only this last week that for the first time in 10 years, she has had two occasions of sleeping for 8 hours. And that was unheard of for her. But she also appreciated that that was what she was wishing for with trying to hurry up the course and get to that point. And she has finally understood that actually that was never going to happen. So a gap in the course on that occasion actually, I think, helped her very much indeed, quite beside the usual practice. So those are two examples of interrupted courses. Yes, Bev.
Tell me if it's not appropriate, because it might be procedural, but I was just interested in those of you who are practicing, whether you charge cancellation fees and how you approach that with your clients.
Well, since you've asked the question, I will give my answer and say, actually, I don't charge a cancellation fee unless the client's been messing me about. And so if it has actually happened 3 or 4 times, and it did with one of them recently, and she volunteered to pay a cancellation fee, to be fair. And so I said, well, okay then. But as a principle, I don't actually have that in my contract bit either. Because on the whole, it's a short course. People are, on the whole, committed. And if they do have to cancel, it's probably a very good reason. For example, the woman with the bereavement, or they're ill or something. And I don't really like charging money for what I'm not giving. So that's a personal thing of my own. What about you, Donna and Patricia?
Okay, Dana, good. No,
No, go on after you.
yeah, I if I'm renting rooms for clients, I tell them that unless they give me, I can't remember, I don't do it anymore, but if it was 48 hours or 24 hours notice, if they didn't give me that, they'd have to pay, because I'd obviously have to pay for the rentals, you know. So, and but if they want to change a date or something, and I'm working from home, I tend not to. And if they, you know, if they have an emergency or whatever, or they're not well, I tend not to charge them. But I know a lot of therapists do charge if people cancel. I don't feel sort of, I don't know, it doesn't feel right for me, as you said, Jane, you know, like charging for nothing. And if it's not bothering me, because I mean, I don't work back to back with clients, you know, it's like I'm not flexible. So I don't charge usually.
And of course, I work from home and I take that for granted. Thank you so much. If you are renting a room, then that actually does impact quite a lot on how you manage things. That's brilliant. Thank you. Donna?
Yeah, I'd echo Patricia, really. I don't tend to rent rooms, but if I did, I would definitely cover myself there. In my contract, I think I need 24 hours notice, but when it comes down to it, again, they usually cancel for very, very good reasons, so I don't enforce it. Because yeah, life happens.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they usually come back, and it's only just an extra week, or perhaps they'll come back the day after, or you know, it's not a huge inconvenience, really.
And it is mostly about that inconvenience, and it's also about the style in which we're working, isn't it? Because if you're going for psychotherapy, you actually buy that slot, don't you, to work with the therapist, and that's how the whole thing works. And so you are, you know, you work, you know, in the contract that if you don't turn up, you're going to be paying for it anyway, which is quite a good psychological thing, because sometimes people haven't done their practice and they're a bit wary about turning up. Pia?
I do the same. I have 24 hours and I do charge them.
Yeah.
And what I have found, I make it very clear to them that, and it goes for me too, if I have an emergency or something, I give them a free session.
Mm-hmm.
So that's
mm-hmm.
how I do it. But what I have found is it is to respect each other's time.
Yes, of course.
And I could have earned money in the time that they were not there, so yeah, I could have given it to somebody else.
Yes,
it and did. If I find somebody else in that hour, yeah, then it's fine. So it's very, very, very rarely that I have to charge them, yeah, but it's accountability.
Yes.
Yes. And that's also, you know, if they have an emergency, somebody had to go to the hospital and whatever with their kid, they fell off a swing. You know, I don't do it because that's life. It's that's not, just, you know, it. But I get good clients and they don't take it. They don't mess me about. So, but I think it can be a good thing to have in the contract that, yes, just to respect each other's time. My, yes, time is just as valuable as yours.
Yes.
So, and yes, no one has never ever said anything. Quite the opposite.
No, actually. No. And I mean, for dentists and everything else, you know, it's all actually, it's about the waste of time, isn't it? Because if you can fill the slot, yes, then everybody's happy. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that makes perfect sense. Thank you. Thank you. I like the word accountability. It also makes me think about responsibility, which is both sides, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, Bev. Right. Well, that's one box ticked for the afternoon. Okay. So setting up the course then. The other thing that I sometimes read in case studies, which is, because when you're writing a case study, you're going to put the date of each appointment. And then I will suddenly read, hang on, this person hasn't come for a month. What's happened here? And there's no explanation for it in the case study. And actually, it could have been a typo and somebody's just written the wrong month in. And it wasn't a month at all. It was only a week. So there are those things. But also, somebody has left an autogenic client with, shall we say, the warmth exercise for a whole month. What would you say about that? Pia's shaking her head, right? As a no-no?
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Why?
So you did say that the therapist leaves the client for a month. Is that,
yes, what you... Well, I'm saying that in the case study, the next appointment afterwards would be the cardiac one, but there's been a whole month.
Okay.
Warmth and the cardiac. So what's going on? I'm asking myself. Okay. Because then I read on and there is no explanation as to why that has happened or what the student did about it or anything like that. So why would that not be recommended? Warmth in particular.
Warmth in particular.
Okay, I'll answer it because I don't want you to get too convoluted.
Yeah.
The warmth exercise, it has followed long heavy. Of course, you've had the short one in between, but then you're into long warmth. Long warmth is the longest exercise in the whole course. Your client is only, it's only the fourth session, so your client is still early on in their process. And to be doing those huge, long exercises, three times a day, for a whole month, they could get into real trouble with their process. So I never recommend that. We never recommend that. But what do we have to help us through that sort of situation? I've mentioned it already today.
The holding exercise.
The holding exercise, exactly. So I would want to read on in that case study where the student writes, Joan had a difficult time with this or that or the other. We agreed she was going to have a, well, maybe it's a bereavement example. We've agreed we're going to take a break at this point, but I gave her the hold exercise to keep her going through it. And if that is not written in there, then I'm quite concerned that the poor client has had a raw deal there. They haven't been taken care of properly. So I'm sorry, Pierre, we're talking about warmth. And obviously,
I have fever, I'm sure, because I'm hot and cold. And can I just clarify? It is the heavy one that we cannot have for 2 weeks, isn't it? Definitely not.
Yes, that's right. Well, that's actually, these are all my opinions, but it's what has happened over the years where I've realised. And in fact, Luther wrote about the fact that the heaviness exercise in full, where it's right the way through all the limbs, is really the whole opener of an autogenic process. So it's a big mistake that early on to leave people on it for too long.
Mm.
Yes. So so it's a bit of a dilemma as to how you manage that. You would talk to your supervisor anyway. If someone can't come to session 3, for good reason, and we've got to wait another week. A day or two wouldn't matter, but a whole other week. Then actually, I would send them. What would I suggest? I know what I do. I modify the heaviness exercise so that it's trigger phrase. My right arm is heavy, and then it's both arms are heavy. Both arms are heavy. Both arms are heavy, and then both legs are heavy. Both legs are heavy. So we're shortening it by not doing the rights and lefts. It's quite a clever idea I've discovered. And after both legs are heavy, put in my arms and legs are heavy. So it's still a nice rounded exercise, but it's not too long. Now, that's not written anywhere. That's just a concoction of my own that I've realised. But that's for very similar reasons, by not having great long warmth for too long. And this one, not, you know, because it's early on in their process. And actually, I mean, I gave you an extreme example. Warmth, that long exercise for a whole month, nobody's going to do it, actually. They're just going to drop it. It's like the brain says, I can't do this, which is probably a good thing. But they're going to drop their AT. And then where are you going to pick it up again? And so on and so on. So the hold exercise is a brilliant answer to all of that. So that's really why we need to be planning the course, so that you are aware when you're making the dates with your client, what number session it is. And I use an old-fashioned diary and pencil. And beside their name in the appointment slot, I'll put the week number. So number 1, you know, is short stitch. And number 2, you know, is heaviness. And number 3, you know, is short heaviness. That's with neck and shoulders, arm and piece. And then you know that number 4 is long warmth. So what's going on at that point? Okay, if you know that someone's going on a holiday the week after, then you will have in your mind to give them the hold exercise when you give them the warmth exercise, so they can swap over at some point after 1 week, and then rejoin at your next appointment, which will be week 5, which you know is the cardiac exercise. And the cardiac shouldn't be left alone for too long either. I think we've covered this in that senior notes somewhere, but quite a lot of people have they're not quite sure about going to heartbeat. Oh, I'm not quite sure. But over the years, I've discovered as long as we follow it with the breathing one quite quickly, then we've got heart and lungs working together as a team, which is how they were designed. Evolution has got us there. Heart and lungs as a team. So sometimes people who are slightly disquieted by the heartbeat one on its own, nothing particularly going wrong, but there's just a little don't know if I really like this, and as soon as we add the breathing to it, oh that was lovely, and it's almost like heart and lungs married up together again. So I'm careful not to have a separation after the, I mean, a long gap after the cardiac one as well. I keep my eye open for that. So after the breathing one, that's actually a very good time to take a break. Week six is the breathing one. So if someone's off on holiday, then you've sending them off with a nice exercise to do. They're quite far into their process. They'll manage it perfectly well with a few little reminders of short stitch, that sort of thing. And then they come back after their holiday and you pick it up from there. Yes, Bev.
So just to confirm, if, say, at week six, they're going on holiday, you wouldn't at that point give them the holding exercise. You would allow them 2 weeks on the exercise up to that point.
Thank you so much for clarifying that. That's right. I think, I mean, the holding exercise is fine. But on the other hand, if they've got to the breathing one, and that's what they should be practicing, yes, absolutely fine to be doing that. I would give the whole lot at that point. Yes. Otherwise, it's like the holding exercise is taking them backwards and you've already got them to that point. So yes, that's all right. Yeah. And the other catch point that I look out for is the solar plexus. At the hospital, we teach the forehead cool with the solar plexus. That's how we fit into the 8 weeks that we're allowed. So you actually got two exercises at that point. But in my own practice, solar plexus on its own, people have different degrees of reaction with that. And it can wake up some emotions. It can be a little bit disturbing. So I would prefer not to have an extra week after that. But all of these things I'm talking about, they've all got to be accommodated within the other person's circumstances and what's going on for them. So none of this is set in stone, but I think it's a useful guideline. I don't know, Donna, have you got any thoughts about that kind of thinking?
No, I'd agree with you, actually, with all of that, especially the solar plexus. I've had some nothing responses and some things that, yeah, I wouldn't want to leave people with as well. So, yeah, it's one that I always hold in my mind and just watch out for.
Yes. And, of course, by the time you've got to that bit, they've had all the offloading exercises. Yeah. So they have actually gone away with the tools that they're probably likeliest to need if they think about it. But of course, they don't often think about it. They just don't like the way they're feeling. And then they stop doing everything. So again, that's a good reason not to have a break at that point if you can avoid it. And then coasting along with a forehead cool and to the end. Yeah. And all of that enhances the importance of introducing the offloading fairly early on. Early on enough so that by 2 weeks before the end of the course, they should have them all. I think in mine it's 3 weeks before the end of the course. No, yes, it is 3 weeks before the end of the course. If we hold back because we've got our own issues about the offloading, don't know if I want to teach these. What are they going to think about it? What are they going to do? Oh, delay it. I'll postpone. I won't do it till next week. And then next week comes along. Oh, gosh, I've got to teach that crying exercise. Oh, no, I don't know. As long as we carry those things into our teaching, it doesn't do the client any, doesn't give them any help at all because they might be needing those things and they don't yet know about them. Yes, Bev?
Yeah, it's interesting. I noticed when I was trying to find the words to talk about autogenic training, I realised that I wanted to include, you know, an element of the offloading part of it in a description, and then to observe in myself a reluctance to do that because I was frightened I'd scare my clients, you know, before they've even got started, that they'll think that they're, you know, coming to do emotional offloading, which, you know, especially when, you know, I think about my husband and there are quite a lot of people out there who would run a mile if you told them that they were going to come and cry and load anger. So yeah, it was interesting to see my own reaction that I'm trying to, you know, plan in advance and I don't know who's going to walk through the door, like you've said. So
But actually, you're wise to realize that as your reaction. Yeah. And at the same time, that does inform the task you're doing. I don't want to put people off, which is absolutely right. So yeah. I would never say that. I can't remember what I do say. We've got something on the website, haven't we, that responses can be all kinds, you know, psychological, physical, emotional, and autogenic training. The whole course addresses all of those areas.
Yeah.
So you can put it in bland language that actually we will be addressing some of this, but no, never ever give away what it is, because they will make people run a mile because it has no context at that point. But the lovely thing is that when you're in a process and the client is working and they're working through, things might have come up for them. Sometimes people say, I hadn't realized how angry I was with the whole family. I'm constantly angry. I hadn't understood it. And then, so, you know, well, we've got an anger exercise. Shall we look at that today? Or maybe it'll be, well, we looked at the anger exercise last week. Did you attach that exercise to how you feel about your anger, about your family? No, I hadn't thought of that. Ah, right. Okay. So it's all got a context then, where something can be understood, not in abstract theory. And enough to, oh, I don't want to go there, thank you very much, and run away. Once we're in the process, they can't run away. They're in there, and they might as well go along with it. So that's planning a course. Do you think we've done that? Have we said all the bits that are there on that one, Donna?
I think so.
Patricia?
Yeah. I think so.
Yes, it's about an unplanned break. Yes. So what will we do when in the week that you were going to move on from warmth and the person rings up and they've got flu or COVID? Oh dear. What are you going to do then?
Depending how ill they are, for instance, I would think someone who is not able to come for some reason, maybe the holding exercise would be something good to offer them.
Yeah, absolutely. Because you know you can't move them on it because they're not going to be with you, and you don't want to leave them for too long on the warmth. So yes, you would, in the interim, say, they might say something other. I'll say, oh, could I come next week or something? No, look, you recover. We'll miss out this appointment. We'll pick things up next week. In the meantime, I'm going to send you a shorter exercise. And yeah. You carry on with that. That'll be brilliant. Yeah. So we're thinking in the moment, aren't we? You need enough realization. Oh, I don't want to break here. What am I going to do? And then the answer will come very quickly. Okay, we'll just do this instead. Are you okay here, Sebastian? You're looking a little, you know.
I think all comes with practice, but you know, I mean, for us, yeah, I think it's a bit delicate from, you know, when you start from scratch, you know, for example, but you never know if a patient, sorry, client, you know, will drop out or whether they have an issue. I think in that case, perhaps, not perhaps, definitely I'm gonna need advice from my supervisor. You know, I think that is the best, because I might not know what is exactly the best thing to do. Because I'm sure every experience, every situation will be particular, will have different ingredients. Mm-hmm.
You're absolutely right there. So, yes, your first port of call will always be your supervisor, and you would have to say something to your client to say, I'll just have to sort something out and make a plan. I'll get back to you. And then you speak to your supervisor, and then a plan is made with perhaps a couple of options that you could then get back to them. And then you'll understand how that is done, and you'll be doing it for yourself from then on. It'll be fine. You are quite right. There's an awful lot. And of course, what I don't like is actually just giving you loads of information like this. And we do need the context. We always need the context. Mm. Yeah. Right. And I said earlier about somebody's messing me about. Can you imagine what that kind of person might be doing?
Counseling.
They are, sorry?
Counseling.
Counseling a lot, yes. Yeah, I mean, did I only meet them in week one and we got to week four and they haven't managed to come back? Is this really suiting them? I think you've got to make a decision there and somehow talk to them. How committed are you? Because we should be halfway through the course by now. Have you had somebody like that, Patricia, ever?
Not in counselling. Oh, no, I have. Yeah, I have. And, yeah, sort of really taking liberties. Saying that we're going away on training for work and that sort of thing. And they weren't, you know, so you have to just let them go eventually, you know.
In the end, it's a conversation, isn't it? Like, well, what are we really getting out of this? If you're not going to practice and you're not going to turn up the appointments, we might as well stop our work now.
Yeah, there seems to be something about a lot of people who do that, is that they just don't really have, they're afraid to tell you they want to give it up. They don't want to carry on.
Good point.
So they keep just cancelling, aren't you?
May I ask you, do you have your clients paying weekly or do they pay a full up the whole amount for the course? What do you do?
Sometimes they want to pay in advance and sometimes they want to pay weekly. I don't mind either way.
What about you, Donna?
I give them a choice as well. I don't mind either way. I've had both. Some people like to get it all out of the way. Exactly. And other people can't perhaps afford that, so they like to do weekly. So, I give them a choice.
I have exactly the same. Yeah. Or sometimes people pay for half a course. Or somebody recently said, okay, he just had the assessment and he's going to pay for the first two sessions. And that rounded it up to a nice figure and he paid for that. So I'm careful to write in my diary whether it's paid or not so that I keep tabs of what's going on. But as you say, some people just like to have they like paying it up front. Think, well, this is a present to myself. You know, it's my Christmas present. And so I want to get that done. And then I can really enjoy it as a real present to me, you know, because I haven't got to pay for it anymore. It's a sort of psychological thing. I've had that said. And the other thing is that I'm always careful to say is that if somebody has paid for the whole lot up front, I always say, thank you very much, but should anything occur which stops your completion of the course for whatever reason, then of course I will refund the unused balance. Mm-hmm. However, we've got to put in for good reason. Mm-hmm. If they've signed up for it and then they decide, I don't really want this anymore, is that really a good reason? So.
Jane, do you want to finish?
Nope.
Sure. I noticed a couple of websites I looked at of practicing therapists. They offer like a reduced rate or a discount if the people pay in full.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yes, and I thought that was really interesting from the point of view of helping people to be committed.
Mm.
Sometimes actually knowing that you've paid it in advance will help in those moments where life gets a bit hectic and. Mm. Genic practice kind of slips down the order of priorities that you've committed and paid for something.
I find with the way that I do it, they buy 12 sessions,
right?
And it is a commitment, and I don't give them the money back, but what it does. It makes them come back.
Yes, it does make them come back. Yes, as somebody said, money talks.
Money talks, and I have been saying that, but it's true. It gives them a reason to come back, and that's why I do it, because often in the work that I do, that they can get a little bit scared with the, it can be heavy, or they don't want to go there where we're going to go, but the money keeps them there, which is silly.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And the story I told only a few moments ago was about the woman who is now suddenly sleeping, having done a lot of work on herself, and she's really taken herself in hand and everything else. So I was congratulating her, and she said, well, actually, a few weeks back, I couldn't understand it. Now I do. She's developing the passion that we've all got now. And she said, frankly, it was because I paid for it. I paid for it. So what on earth am I doing by giving up? And that was the talking to she gave herself. Yeah.
And Bev, you know, I give discounts as well. But yeah, the way I do it, I have my set price for the session. And that is what it is. If they want to have a discount, it's actually not a discount, because the discount is what I said it at. Does that make sense what I'm saying? Probably not. But let's say that it's $100 for a session. And I don't even know what I'm saying here. So it's $100 for a session. And if they have 10 sessions, let's say it's $1,000. So that is my price. But the discounted price is my real price. Does that make sense?
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. A friend of mine told me to increase my.
That's it. That's what I want to say.
And then discount back to what I charge. So I think that's what you're trying to say, is you actually put your rates up and then discount it back down so people think they're getting a deal.
That's so interesting, because it's the psychology that all the supermarkets use.
Totally. It's psychology.
More, you know, if I see that my husband's expensive coffee is on offer, then several packets go in the bag. But do I recall what it costs normally? You know, when I see a label with money slashed off, I think I'm getting a good deal. Yeah.
It's all psychology.
Yes, I do see what you're saying. Yes. Interesting. Very interesting. Right. What have we done? We've planned a course. We've talked about managing the steps and the dates. And, you know, if it's a simple 9-week straightforward through, nothing to worry about, fine. But all the other little bits. Okay. What else have we got on the timetable here? Following the client process. Therapist observation, client feedback. I have no idea what might come out of any of those headings.
Therapist observation. Well,
that's difficult.
Therapists are observing constantly, aren't they? Or I would imagine they are.
I'm sorry, I missed the key word there, Patricia. You imagine they're what?
No, well, I would just think, that goes without saying, therapist observing their client, you know, always.
I see what you mean. Yes, absolutely. We are observing, aren't we? I observed, dear Pierre, on first glance on Zoom, that you were not well. Either that or you'd had a really bad night and you were getting, well, you are, anyway, it's neither here nor there. So there's obviously that first initial facial impact of when a person walks into the room or appears on the screen. Oh, what's going on here? So, okay, so that's one thing. Actually, it's a good one, though, to start with, because, okay, Pierre is ill. Okay, somebody in the middle of an autogenic process. What I've learned is that when they look really well and bright-eyed and absolutely sort of, ooh, and I'm thinking, gosh, their autogenics is doing stuff here. And I've learned now not to say, oh, you do look well, because when they sit down, they're quite likely to burst into tears and tell me what an awful week they've had, and this has upset them, and that's upset them, and it's all been so surprising, and they're really not. So I've learned now not to say to anybody how well they look on arrival until I've heard where they're at and what's been going on for them. It's quite interesting, because then when we've heard the story, and yes, they've obviously been doing a lot of, I'll call it offloading, but it's not intentional offloading. It's just their process has just taken them into realms of emotional release that they were not expecting. And it's been quite distressing. But actually, it's that has cleared their face. And that's why they're looking so well. So sometimes this is just a little sort of pictorial detail of the observations that I've learned just to hang fire. You've got something, Pia, on that.
Yeah, I've observed over the years that the people pleasers, they always come in smiling. Always. And then they sit down and then whoo.
Yeah.
Then you. So I totally agree with that. I never say that either. So yeah, that's good to. Yeah.
Well, but what's interesting there is that I wasn't actually talking about people pleasers. I know what you're saying as well. But actually, there's something, it's not necessarily about the smile. What I usually notice, look, I can take my glasses off because of my eye surgery, is there's a sort of relaxation around the eyes. Patricia and Donna, I'm sure you know what I mean. That we sometimes just see that. We think their eyes are wider. There's something going on there. They may not actually be smiling, but there's just something in their face which is telling me, I don't know, what is it telling me? Sort of relaxation, that's not quite the right thing, but or maybe they're more in tune with themselves or something. So I think, but of course it can go both ways. Of course the people pleasers are always going to be bright and breezy and not give anything away. I absolutely get that. And then they sit down and then it comes out. But so that's good as well, of course. That's wonderful. And yeah. Well, that's observation of one kind. What other kind of client observation are we going to encounter, do you think?
So the body language. The body language, the tone of their voice and if they want to have eye contact or not.
Yeah. Yes, all sorts of things, which have probably been going on anyway, but there might be a particular day and you think, oh, what's going on with this person? Something not quite right here. Yes, absolutely. Body language
That's
is huge.
That's why our intuition is so important.
Yes. Yes. And that is probably the time to keep quiet, isn't it? And not say, oh, what's going on? But just let the session unfold. Yeah. What about actually teaching AT, teaching autogenics?
Observing the posture that the client puts.
Yeah.
Throughout the course.
Yeah. Oh, you're talking about in an autogenic exercise in particular, or just any old?
Yeah, so on the sort of the heading of client observation, teaching, you know, because we won't have our eyes closed when we're going through the exercise. Yeah. We'll be observing the client to make sure they're in the correct posture.
Yes, sure.
So looking, you know, that they're in the autogenic state, that they're using passive concentration. Mm-hmm.
How do you know someone's in an autogenic state? That's a trick question, actually. Go on, Pia, go on.
With the breathing, but also their facial muscles, they very often they have the slack part of, you know, their hangs. They can drool.
They can drool. Yeah. Quite right. Yeah. Okay. Those are physical signs of certainly a change, the drooling and the relaxation, very different to when they're sort of talking and bright and breezy and all of that, certainly. But do you, Donna, know when you are in an autogenic state, just for your own practice?
I think so. Something changes, but it's really difficult to describe what it is somehow.
I very blandly say to my clients, we really don't know what an autogenic state is. Actually, we do, but perhaps we can't name it and we can't describe it and we don't know why it's there and why it's there on Tuesdays and it isn't there on Fridays and all sorts of stuff. So actually, we don't need to worry about whether somebody is in an autogenic state. But of course, there are the sides that you're mentioning, and that's all about the relaxation response. Tummy rumbles is another one. I always give lots of applause for tummy rumbles. Yeah. but actually, some of those we might not notice in observation, where we depend on our clients to tell us. And often it's a bit embarrassed, you know, well, I was drooling. I didn't, well, I had to keep swallowing. And we say, well done. Mm. Or, oh, my tummy rumbled. I'm ever so sorry, they say. Mm. Well, you don't have to be sorry. Go on, Bev.
Yeah, I'm curious just how this conversation's gone. Like, what would you say, Jane, Donna and Patricia, is the difference between the relaxation response in the body and the autogenic state?
Mm. I think for me, the relaxation is my body, my physical body, my muscles, etc., feeling the difference of, you know, that the relaxation there. And I think the autogenic state is my head. Mm. That there's a sort of a calmness there, a serenity, mm, if you like, almost. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So mind, body.
Mind, body, certainly. And that's your personal, shall we call it, realization. Having been asked the question, I think that's what it is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Lovely. Donna.
Yeah, I'd say the same. I don't think I can get into a sort of the autogenic state without the relaxation, because otherwise, yeah, I become very aware of my body and it stops, mm-hmm, stops me letting go, maybe. Mm. It's almost like the postures let me let go of my body, and then the autogenics let me let go of my mind, mm-hmm, somehow. Mm. If that makes any sense at all.
But I thank you, Pia.
This is really interesting because I worked with Zen monks for a long, long time, and also I do Zen meditation, if you like, and I always say to them, because they are so amazed that I could get into what they call the Zen state, and I say it was autogenics, and what they in Zen and how they explain it, and this is my experience, is that when I am in the autogenic trait, my body is relaxed, but the body is the gateway for the state. And when I am in the autogenic state, there's no judgment at all. There is no really thoughts of how things should be, but there's total acceptance of the now, how that is at that particular moment, even if I'm in pain or whatever, there is an acceptance of what it is. It's a, what they call the blissful state.
The which so state they call it?
The bliss.
The bliss, yes, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, isn't that interesting? Bliss, warts and all. The pain, exactly, the difficulties, the thoughts, everything else. Yes, or perhaps no
and
thoughts.
And not wanting the now to be different, it just is.
Yeah, it just is. Yes.
Mm. And it's such a beautiful way. And I say, but that's it. That's what I found. Yeah, yes. So it was just interesting.
Yeah.
So that's what I my experience is. Yeah.
Mm. That's really, really interesting. And of course, what we're also looking at is the inevitable overlaps between one thing and another. And I think that's what I want to avoid, that our clients are sort of wondering if they're doing it right. And is this really autogenic, or is it like mindfulness, or is it something else, or is it something else? So what we experience for ourselves is really all that we have. That's my answer to that question. And then, because so that was a horrible question I asked you at the start, because I knew that perhaps nobody really knows exactly what the autogenic state is or compared with anything else, because I don't see how they can. So I asked you a mean question then. So and then you extended it, Bev. How does it compare What did you say? I've forgotten now. Autogenic state and something else. What you said. And relaxation, yes. And actually, what Patricia and Donna have just said so eloquently is it's both. It has to be both. And then, of course, but it's much better for you to discover it, which you probably already have 100 times over, maybe without even knowing it. And there we are. We've got our names for it. But I beat the drum of Luther, who said casual and nonchalant. And if we've really been casual and nonchalant, then we've got a casual and nonchalant brain going with a casual and nonchalant body. But I love what you said. You both said it in slightly different ways, Patricia and Donna. I couldn't get the brain into that place if the body wasn't there first, you effectively said, didn't you? And I go along with that absolutely entirely. I always say when I'm describing AT, it uses relaxation. That for me, is a useful way to say, we're not going to teach you relaxation. It's not a relaxation technique. It uses relaxation. And then we've got the bit that satisfies the human brain to have something to do up here with these little phrases. And that just quietens down our beings for those moments. But we've all got different ways of explaining it.
Thank you, Pia and Patricia. That was really insightful how you described that. And as you were talking, Jane, it reminded me of how many meditation practices have a focus of concentration, whether it's the breath, whether it's the belly center, you know, a mantra. And in a way, for me personally, you know, saying the formulas is a form of concentration practice for the mind to help with intruding thoughts. Mm-hmm. While my body gets on with the business of entering that relaxation response. Mm. And then, yeah, the fact is, I think with autogenics, we close. So we take ourselves out of that state. It's short. Mm. Whereas in meditation, you know, some of them, the retreats, you can be in, you know, a meditation state for much, much longer, experiencing different degrees of those states.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that is where, of course, all these overlaps are really quite, well, they're very interesting. But the people who don't get on with meditation or with mindfulness, and I've talked to a fair number, are actually having autogenic experiences, reactions, discharges.
Yeah.
But they don't know that, and neither do their teachers know that. So they don't have any support or any kind of validation or recognition. It's usually, or at least, you know, the times I've been talking about it, somebody will say they've been dismissed. Say, oh, don't worry about that. Just let it go. Just let it go. Well, actually, if it's really disturbing us, we can't let it go. And we're not supposed to. In our language, we would say, right, this is something to attend to. What have we got to do that with? Is this some anger, some anxiety? Do we need to cry? You know, we can actually do something with it and move it out. And those poor meditators don't have anything like that. So they give up. And that actually can cause more problems.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
I came across a man a few months ago who had been trying for years and years to meditate, a very sort of stressed sort of man. And he was almost in tears telling a group of friends, you know, he started saying, I've tried it and it just doesn't work. And I don't know, and other people can do it and I can't get it and da, da, da. And I felt so sorry for him. And I said, don't know, I can sort of give you something maybe that will help you relax. So I didn't say anything about autogenics. I said, it's just a sort of thing, you know, and I sort of very briefly talked about the body scan. And so he sat himself in a chair and he closed his eyes and he breathed, et cetera. And I did a slow body scan. And then I had already showed him how to close when I told him, you know, and all that. And then I talked about intruding thoughts and that kind of thing, you know, just let them go. Mm-hmm. He I thought he'd fallen asleep at the end of it when I was saying it and sort of talked him into the close. And then he just put his head back and he went, oh, that was wonderful. I mean, he does it himself now. And he's actually into meditation, proper, you know, meditation, like guided meditation and things. And all that just simply from the body scan, the AT body scan.
Isn't that interesting? Well, of course, mindfulness is a very long, I mean, that's where they start, isn't it? Hugely long body scans. But of course, then the other thing is that I as soon as you said guided meditation there, I was thinking, oh no, I hate guided meditation. Somebody else is telling me what I've got to do. I mean, that's the one thing I loathe, to be perfectly honest, doing AT. But if he's picked that up and that's his way, absolutely fine. I'm not going to nobody would quarrel with it. But isn't that, it is interesting. I mean, these things are so closely aligned, it's very hard to pull them apart, Pia.
This is why I love the work with Gabor Maté. He, the doctor, I don't know if people...
I've heard of him.
He's brilliant. He talks a lot about trauma. Mm. And there are so many people that can't sit still simply because they are in trauma brain. And they are there all the time. And they don't know. That's why they can't sit still. This is why I so love autogenics, because exactly what Patricia is saying, giving them an opportunity to actually connect with their body.
Yeah,
which is in a safe way, but it has to be done with an AT, you know, therapist. But yes, it's interesting because one that I work a lot with and teach as well is a Zen master called Genpo Roshi, and they have done a lot of brain scans when they sit in their meditation, which is, it goes to theta waves. But if we are in trauma brain, we can't get there. Mm. This is why autogenics is so vital to get it out there. Mm. Because I believe.
No, you're right. You're right. And trauma brain surely means I've got to run away, which is why they can't sit still. Yeah.
That's it. Mm. And actually, can I ask you a question here, Jane? Because in my line of work and with the kind of clients that I get, it's people that they have done a lot of work on themselves over the years, but they never quite got there.
Mm.
And then I use voice dialogue and it changes their lives, but I want to have the body in. And that's why I became a psychosomatic therapist. And we use the two first, in a bit different way, the two first, the heaviness and also the warmth. Yeah. So they use that. And I've used that forever. I've never gone further with autogenics because they get a lot out of the first two exercises.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right here. Is it okay in my presentation to talk about the trauma brain?
Yes.
It is good because that's what yes, my presentation, you know, is. And they say, oh, this makes so much sense.
Exactly.
That was exactly what got them. There were seven people I did the presentation to. Mm. I told them about the trauma brain and what it actually does when we have the response, when we're in flight, fight, fawn, or, yeah? Okay, that's good. Thank you.
Mm. And if the trauma, it doesn't matter what the trauma is or how long ago it occurred, and some things can be directly related to events in childhood or whatever it might be. But then I say to people, actually, the autonomic nervous system, which controls this, has actually just got into a bad habit. That's all it is. And autogenic training, it gets into a cycle, of course, that the more we feel bad, then the more of a failure we feel and everything else, and the worse our symptoms get. And then the more the symptoms get, then the more bad we feel and the anxiety. And what autogenic training does is just prick that cycle. We're just breaking it. And we're teaching ourselves. It's not called autogenic training for nothing. That's another good thing to explain to people. We know that auto is self. We know that the training is applied by the self to the self. And we also know that anything that arises out of it comes from within the self. And then, of course, the word training is we are retraining our bodies with different reactions, helping ourselves to cope with past traumas or whatever it might be. It's a brilliant name. It's just that we have to educate it, have to educate everybody about it.
You know what I say to them? I said in my presentation, yeah, I said what I've cut it up, dissected what it actually means. And I say, I cannot stand the word autogenic training because it's not sexy.
And no, they no, laughed. Exactly.
And it's like, it's a terrible word. But then when I explained what it actually means, it made sense to them. And then it went away with their resentment to the word, if that makes sense.
So I quite agree with you. We've been saying for years how unsexy the name is of autogenic training. And Donna and Patricia, you will know of people who try to come up with different names. You know, shall we call it autogenic mindfulness, or shall we call it mindful autogenics? And then, or shall we call it something else relaxation? And shall we call it, and no, nothing says what it actually is except the name we have. Bev, you came up with a new name.
No, I'm laughing because it does say what it does, but also because I studied German, I'm laughing because German is such a precise language, but it's also, I'm trying to look for the English word for this. You know how French is the language of romance? German is the language of acute grammar.
Oh, so right.
Okay. Not sexy. It's not a sexy language by definition. No. So I imagine, you know, when it was came up, it's a very grammatical, scientific, hard, masculine word.
Yes.
Were we creating a name for it now, it probably would be different in a different culture. Yeah.
Well, I tell you what, let's go. Thank you so much. That's really helpful. Let's call it autogenic happiness.
But you know, it can have an advantage in a roundabout way if you're with the right people. I was, you know, the other day, I was with, my son-in-law and his sister, and she's, you know, an open-minded person, and she said, what is that thing you do, Patricia? What exactly is it? You know, and my daughter was there. My daughter actually took over explaining correctly, actually, about what it was. So if you get, and you know, some people are interested enough just by the name, they want to find out what it is.
Yes, curiosity. Yes. Yeah,
and it's, they're the sort of people that you think will probably take it up, you know. I think actually this woman I'm talking about is probably thinking about doing it, and her mother. So they live in an area where there are lots of all different kinds of therapists, and I suppose this is something they haven't heard of, so they're probably the first people to try it or something, you know.
So I'm a psychosomatic therapist, and what I have decided to do is, because I'm looking at spreading autogenics here in Australia to not just for a small group, and I had a meeting with a marketing expert, and I call what I teach in those two sessions, well, it's a longer program where it's only the first, the heaviness, and then the warmth. And he says, if you say autogenic training, he says, mm-mm-mm. And I said, but that is what it is. And he says, the best thing is to think about, and this is, I don't know about IT, search optimization. Mindfulness is something that is Googled all the time and has a lot of hits. And somatic is something that comes up. And he says, what you are doing is that you are using, so I've done for years, somatic mindfulness.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, if you put that in, but you have it, somatic mindfulness, autogenic training, it's like you hit so many.
That's interesting.
And that's what I'm going to do. Yeah. Get it in that way, and just cast the net wide and then get them in.
That's interesting,
Sebastian. I'm a bit confused, or maybe you might let me know. You talk about heaviness and warmth exercise. Do you teach them as a part of the autogenic training, or you have incorporated these two exercises in your own practice, combining with something else? Could you let me know, because I didn't get it right?
I'm a psychosomatic therapist, which is that we do a voice dialogue and you get in touch with your body. And it's just a mindfulness exercise where you, it's like a body scan, really.
But is this, have you developed this technique? I mean, did you extract
it? No. Yeah, this for somebody else.
Because as far as I'm aware, we were told not to mix any, you know, any, I mean, 80s, 80. Oh,
no. Yeah, and I won't mix it. Autogenics is absolutely autogenics. But I'm going to use it as in the search words, because I would still do my voice dialogue with body awareness. So, but it's two different things.
But you haven't started practicing yet pure autogenics, as far as I'm aware.
No.
But thank you.
I think we could also allow the words heavy and warm to go into other, because a heavy and warm could occur in meditation and other things as well, couldn't it? So I think we, you know, as a loose term, it's fine. I don't think that, in fact, I know Pierre isn't actually talking about giving the warmth exercise our water jet to anybody else. It's just the idea, just a notion, I'm guessing. Is that,
I think there is another exercise. It's called deep muscle relaxation, which induces
we'll
the sensation
come to that.
Of having
progressive muscle relaxation.
Or whatever it's his name. Yeah.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. That's a different thing. We'll talk about that in another. There are many.
So many.
Yes, and actually, that's why I'm quite sort of loose about all of that. You know, don't let's worry the clients with exactly what they're doing. We are teaching them what we are teaching them. We can leave it at that. Yes. Thank you for that. I'm realizing that we've gone way over time and we should already have done our next session by now. But we have already tackled to modify or adjust, because we talked about reduce and omit and postpone and all those things, and contact your supervisor. So I think we could leave that. I think that's going to come up more when we're more into our teaching. Donna, advice, what shall we do with the running a follow-up session? Because we should be having tea now so we can do the tutorial. And my immediate thought is read the notes, because I only sent them last night. Mm-hmm. And we'll pop it in when they're nearer to running a follow-up group.
Yeah, I think that's good, because it'll be fresher then as well and more relevant.
Indeed.
Yeah, I'd appreciate that.
Right. So I must make a note. That is going to be moved to another day.
I'm going to stop recording.